Hello and welcome to the Walk Podcast. My name's Lena Rowland, Head of Content for Walk Strategy, and today's podcast is going to be a fun one. For those of you who spend some time on LinkedIn or Twitter X, you may have seen there has been a lot of love recently for the JWT Planning Guide. Now, this is a document that was published 50 years ago. It's just celebrated its birthday. It was first published in March 1974. Now, for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Planning Guide, it's a 34-page document that was typewritten by Stephen King. Now, this is Stephen King from the 1970s UK advertising industry fame. He's a legend in the industry and not to be confused with the American crime writer. Now, this planning guide, it's a toolkit for those of you that aren't familiar with it. It summarises the theories on which JWT's planning methods were based, and it sets out a framework for best practice planning techniques and how to understand the process of marketing and brand building. It summarises things like how do brands appeal and who do they appeal to, and the role of emotional and rational appeals. It looks at fundamentals like the role of advertising, how communications work, and talks about setting advertising objectives and target audiences. And the guide also introduced the now famous advertising planning cycle framework. As I say, there's tons of really useful information in there. But I think why we wanted to have this podcast today is because, yes, this document was really influential at the time, but interestingly, what's really fascinating is that the theories and frameworks appear to be as relevant today as they were half a century ago. So it's a 50-year-old gem of goodness and enduring relevance. To help me understand how this guide is maintaining its relevance and why it's still relevant today, I'm delighted to be joined by two strategists, Josh Bulmer, Chief Strategy Officer at Leo Burnett, and Rachel Mercer, former CXO of Proto, and prior to that was Head of Strategy at RGA. Rachel is also a co-host of the Overthinkers podcast. Josh, Rachel, welcome to the Walk podcast.
Thank you for having us, Lena.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be with you both.
Yeah, you're both first timers on the Walk podcast. So it's my delight to host you guys on what should be a really fun and interesting topic. So let's get stuck in. First up, I'm curious about when you first read the planning guide, were you giving it as part of your induction process at your agency, or did you hear about it via a colleague? How did you discover it? And if you wouldn't mind explaining how the guide has helped you in your career.
So I think, as has been debated aplenty on Twitter or X and LinkedIn, I think a lot of American planning and strategy has been for a long time what felt like the Wild West. So I was a strategist coming of age in the sort of like mid-aughts. I did not have any form of sort of like formalized training. I was lucky to come up through the sort of very contrarian view that was Crispin Porter and Bogusky, where it was like a much more media-centric brief, but there wasn't necessarily a defined view of planning. I was lucky enough to also be trained at Deutsch under Bud Cadell, who created a lot of like digital strategy 101 documentation. But I kept on being told or like learning about that a sort of differentiated discipline, which was called planning. And there was like this artificial divide in the States between strategy and planning for quite a long time. And so being a sort of child of the internet, of course, I sort of was just turning to any set of resources that I can find. I had read a bunch of different books, but hadn't actually found something that covered the foundations of planning. And when I found the JWT Planning Guide, I want to say around like 2008, 2009, it felt like the first time it was something that was actually like simplified down to the core parts of the process that I could understand. And it was something that I certainly revisited time and again, especially because American strategy being sometimes a Wild West, you have to start creating frameworks and tools for your own teams to start referring to. And I, you know, I'm not a fan of reinventing the wheel. So we certainly revisited it many number of times since. But Josh, I'm hoping we can compare and contrast, because I assume that you may have had a more traditional upbringing, but we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, I think actually there's some uncanny parallels, actually, because I started out over here and I started out in digital agencies as well, actually. So I was super hungry to learn more about traditional brand strategy, I suppose. And again, so similarly, around a similar time to when you were discovering it over your side of the pond, I was as well over here. I wasn't aware that there's a divide between strategy and planning in the US. That's an interesting nuance. Maybe that's a whole separate podcast. Let's not go into that one.
Josh, that is a separate session.
Okay, brilliant. I won't. This is the curious brain. I'm eager to hear more. But no, I found it for similar reasons. And over here, JWT, well known as one of the homes of planning. And so that's why I was drawn to it as a bit of a Bible, I suppose. And if it was the Bible for the home of planning, that made sense to me.
Did you kind of seek it out then, Josh, as part of you, as you say, it was a kind of like an educational play for learning more about traditional advertising as opposed to the digital space?
Absolutely that. And so I discovered it. I actually realised that I had a personal connection to it as well, albeit a slightly tenuous one. I'm called Josh Bullmore. Jeremy Bullmore is a distant relative of mine, and he is well known over here as a legend of the industry, I suppose. And so I sought him out to ask him for wisdom and advice. And actually, to my regret, he passed away recently. I only had one lengthy conversation with him, but he was talking about the birth of planning and by implication, the birth of this guide and how he worked with Stephen King, the author of this guide, amongst the various anecdotes and pearls of wisdom he passed on. So that was amazing, actually, to hear from him. He would have been there in the early 70s, working on some of the practices that then got codified into this wonderful guide.
Amazing. Yeah, and indeed, Josh, Jeremy Bullmore was indeed a legend of the industry, so highly regarded. So I want to move on to talk about the frameworks and theories. It's fair to say that the advice in there and the frameworks, they're still incredibly relevant to modern marketers, which is quite interesting given all the change, the dominance of the platforms, the rise of influencers and creators, the shrinking of monoculture. So first, do you agree that there is enduring relevance? And if so, does this surprise you?
To me, no. It doesn't surprise me that it's enduring, but I do think it's very much a product of its time and the necessity of it, right? Like if you think about, again, Stephen King or JWT in context, right? By the time that he authored this, JWT was already one of the oldest advertising agencies and one of the largest that existed globally. It was celebrating something like its centennial, and that's part of what sort of incited the creation of this document. But you have to think that, and I think all of us have gone through this in the period of scaling your business, is that suddenly you cannot individually manage every single project or process anymore. And so I do think what, if I was to project myself and to put myself into Stephen King's shoes, again, having been sort of like a director of research and then a director of planning, the best way to get to consistently good work and build the brand of JWT is to codify a lot of those principles and practices. And I also think that what happens necessarily is like once you distill it down to its simplest form, it's a little bit like the Bauhaus curriculum, right? Where I think they codified and broke down all of the different aspects of design very simply into sort of the materials, the form, and the function. And I think it's difficult to sort of like reinvent the wheel when all of the fundamentals are foundationally there and the same. So I do think part of the reason why it hasn't changed is because it was distilling marketing to its sort of most basic form. And I do think it's also the reason why no one has sort of like created necessarily something new or different is even with the sort of like evolving media landscape that we do have, that actually centers us back down into like drop in the bucket tactics and forgets those critical parts of the planning cycle, which is like revisiting what our original objective was. How are we measuring against that objective? And are we continuing to invest in that cycle? Which I think is where most brands' growth objectives or even sort of like influencer and media tactics tend to fall off, because they tend to be sort of one-off ingredients versus necessarily a systemic plan. I will get off my soapbox now. I apologize.
It's perfect.
No, I like the soapbox. I was just about to build on one of your points about the importance of codifying something when you're growing, or when that point of it's more than a couple of people who are looking to do something. And that's my understanding from what Jeremy Bullmore told me, was that, because I think prior to the emergence of planning's predecessors were probably, as you say, the research department. And I think back to how they were portrayed in the Mad Men series, which I didn't get through all of the seasons of it, but they're not portrayed very favorably as like right at the heart of it. And I think one of the things that happened, as I understand it, at JWT was that, well, certainly the way Jeremy told it anyway, was that there was this partnership between Jeremy and Stephen, where they worked in partnership in a way that creatives and the voice of the customer, or planners, what do you want to describe them, hadn't necessarily worked before. And so I think this is possibly the role for the document was, in part, exactly as you're saying, Rachel, was trying to codify that. And I think in a way about trying to codify that working relationship. It's quite interesting, not just on the craft of planning, but also on how to work and how to, it says early on about the importance of stimulating creativity in imagination and it being something of a process to do that. So I think it was, yeah, it's an interesting exercise to try and transport ourselves back 50 years. And you imagine that's what they were trying to do, trying to encourage others, other planners, to be able to have that same kind of relationship that they'd enjoyed so fruitfully and successfully.
Yeah, and I think at the time, JWT, a lot of their clients were big multinational brands, actually. So it was really, they were obviously learning an awful lot about how to build brands and how to do this really, really well. And I think the word that you've used quite a bit there, Rachel, which is what I really love about the document, is the simplicity.
No, absolutely. And I love that you point that out, Lena, about the type of client relationships that JWT also had at the time, because I also think this foundationally also reframes your relationship with your client as one that is longstanding, right? It's a challenge in the business right now where everything is a sort of project-based fee. There's no, those big, large retainer contracts are sort of fewer and further between. And I do think that JWT positioned and understood itself, or even Stephen King probably understood that, you know, one-off flash in the pan engagements were not only going to be bad for the clients, but was also going to reflect poorly on JWT and create some volatility within there. And so what I love about this too is it does create, again, sort of those foundations and behaviors, like you said, Josh, around not only sort of the relationship within the agency, but also that partnership with our clients that I think is something that is easy to lose sight of these days as well.
Absolutely. Longevity, or the short-termism in so many industries, or built into so many financial markets, certainly in the world of marketing and advertising, just isn't helpful. And shorter tenures of CMOs, which lead to shorter tenures of agencies, or even project-based, as you're saying, increasingly, it does mitigate against the sometimes difficult and challenging but long-term decisions you need to make. Absolutely. There was another point I was going to make, actually, to build on what we were discussing about it feels a bit, I don't know what you guys think, but it feels a bit like the world has sort of turned 360 degrees and come back a little bit to where it was 50 years ago, in that sort of back in the 70s, agencies were what you might call truly full service. You had creative and media and all the channels all under one roof. And then it feels like across the 80s and 90s, there was fragmentation into lots of different disciplines. And when I started out sort of, 25 long years ago now, there were lots of specialist agencies and clients were engaging a lot of specialists. So there'd be a digital agency, a direct agency, an advertising agency, and there are lots of specialists. Now feels in the last 5 years, like increasingly, I'd be interested to know if this is true in the US as well, Rachel, but in the UK, it feels like there's actually been a lot of consolidation now, not least actually the JWT as an agency brand, of course, no longer exists. That's been rolled up into an integrated agency. And we're certainly finding at Leo's that we're increasingly being asked to look at creativity across the board, whether that's broadcast or social or direct response. And that, for me, a bit like long-termism versus short-termism, I think having one strategy that reaches and is executed as well across everything is much the better way, both in terms of effectiveness and efficiency. So it feels like we've gone 360 and actually back to a world where there's more generalization than specialization than there had been previously, which makes the guide, gives it renewed relevance, certainly to my eyes. But I don't know, Rachel, whether that's also something you'd agree with or that's a very UK-centric way of looking at the world.
No, I think we have gone through the boom and bust cycle similarly here in the States of the very hyper-fragmentation into specialist roles and to rebundling everything together. I think the primary holding companies are also pushing a lot of that as well with their relationship with, as Lena was saying, for JWT's early clients. When you have clients that are multinationals and you do need a sort of singular point of contact or servicing, I do think the holding companies are certainly leaning towards that way. I do also think the scale of our marketing globally does require a bit more nuance now because, again, what has worked for Ariel in the UK is not going to necessarily work for Ariel in India or China or whatever, which is like the level that the relationship is often being set at.
I would agree.
But you're right that the foundationals are the same.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that as well. So we work on global and local. I work on McDonald's as one brand, and that's a brand that's been built on making it feel, in the UK, there was a Guardian headline described it as British as fish and chips. And that's one of the great strengths of its brand over here, that it's become part of the fabric of Britain, really. So, yeah, that's one of the tensions, isn't it? The global versus local. But I agree, brands are often built from the ground up.
Right, I want to stick with the theme of theories and frameworks because, that's what the guide is all about. I'm going to ask each of you, I don't mind who goes first, which ones out of all those discussed, there's reference to long and short in there, even though long and short isn't actually referred to as long and short, but direct and indirect. Which ones do you want to highlight and which ones would you say are important today, as important today as they were half a century ago?
Okay, well, I'm going to hold up the planning cycle. I'm jumping in first because it's I think it's so powerful. The planning cycle, which he frames as a set of questions to answer. Where are we? Why are we there? Where could we be? How could we get there? Are we getting there? Leading back around to where are we? And on it goes. And I think there's a few elements of genius in here. Rachel, you've already talked to the simplicity, and I just love the simplicity. There's five parts of this process. The other thing I love about it is the fact that they're framed as questions. He talks early on about it being needing to balance sort of process, structure and freedom. And so he sets it as questions for you to answer rather than specific steps that you should go through. So it gives you, I guess, a direction of travel, but how you travel is up to you and your team and your clients and all the rest of it. And personally, I think this has got just such timeless relevance, but also to all sorts of problems of different altitude, from quite a specific challenge to grand brand repositioning moments that happen every five or so years, through to, I think you can apply it to anything as well. Loads of times people have asked me how to approach a problem, whether it's clients looking at something within the world of marketing or beyond. And frankly, I think you could apply those five questions to anything, to your career and planning your career, to life. I think you could probably launch quite a successful life coaching business on the back of those five questions. So I think they are simple but incredibly powerful, and can't see why they wouldn't continue to be relevant for the next 50 years as well.
No, I absolutely agree. I love what you were saying, Josh, about how applicable it is to many contexts. You know, I've sort of left my agency days and have been working in-house lately and more with teams of designers on products than anything else. And I do still bring that out as a way to do diagnosis of where we are with our products or features or anything like that as well. I think that it easily feels like a foundational piece to design thinking in a lot of ways.
Oh, really?
There's two. I do think so. We talk about the double diamond discovery or whatever else. How is that all that different from the planning cycle?
Very true.
Not discover, define, design, deliver.
Yeah.
Feels very similar.
Yeah.
So two frameworks that are in here that are not the shining graphic, but I do think if you squint, they're ones that I do point teams to quite a lot. And the first one is on page 19. It's the comparative map. But if you squint and look at it, it really is sort of the four C's, where you're looking at category, competition, what is happening with the company, what is happening with the customer. And then, of course, like what is happening in culture. There's a greater breakout here because we've added in, you know, the brand's market position or the marketing activities. But I think this distilled down really does become the foundation of the four C's. And I always go back to that when I am starting any type of analysis for thinking through new ideas, when I'm trying to get smart on a potential client. Any of those types of things, I think, is always a very helpful frame. And then when we're talking about sort of why are we there or where could we be on page 26, when you're talking about the new marketing mix, there's also an introduction of the four P's. So product, packaging, price, and promotion. I always go back to those as well when we start to talk about putting tactics forward or recommendations forward to a client. So I always find those to be helpful and fairly easy to remember for team members when you're using these as training materials.
I like the way you're developing a user's guide to the user guide here, with like pointing us around the page numbers, etc. This is great. I'm looking at page 19. This could be a listen along activity for people at home, should they so desire. But that, as you say, for the comparative map as a basis for the four C's. You couldn't do much better than have that one page next to you when you're trying to work out, diagnose where you are and why. Mm-hmm. That set of questions, you couldn't have a better one pager, could you? I think that is one to print off and put above your desk.
As our listeners can hear, anyone unfamiliar with this guide, you've got reference to the four C's in there, and you've also got reference to the four P's of marketing. So tons of great advice and frameworks in there. And Josh, that planning cycle is one that I have used as well myself here within Walk. So it is so widely relevant. And his tone of voice, I feel, is very self-assured and confident, which is nice because we're not always a very confident, it's not always a very confident industry. So maybe that's why it's enduring as well. It's nice to have this document written so simply. I really like the underlined bits as well. I don't know what you think. It just draws your attention to the key points.
There is a sense of person that comes through, isn't it? I think it's partly because if you have a look at it online, it does look like it's been hand-typed. So it feels very immediate. It feels like mm-hmm. this sort of time capsule from the past, but also there are just glimpses of personality in there. There's definitely self-assurance. Definitely he was clearly a bright visionary thinker. But then there are moments like at the end of the one of the first pages, he says this document aims to summarize the theories which planning methods are based and to set out a framework for planning which represents what the best planners are doing anyhow. So there's sort of a kind of humility to it, which is, I mean, I know that the best people are probably doing this anyway, but I thought I'd write it. It sort of doesn't take itself as being too much of the Bible, despite it being really rather excellent.
Yeah.
So there's just a little glimpse of the man as well as the brain that comes through occasionally.
Which is really nice.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. No, I appreciate there's a couple of things in there where I'm like, you can see the experience coming through and some real world takes. So again, I'm going to give page numbers, assuming that someone wants to be following along. But on page 20, towards the end, they're talking about the diagnosis, the where are we in this conversation. And the closing sort of paragraph, which is just kind of thrown in there, says, needless to say, the value of where are we and why are we there depends on their being answered with complete honesty and realism on both like the agency behalf and the client's behalf. And I think it is like a, not a tongue in cheek, but an acknowledgement of sort of, I think, the realities of some of those gaps that exist in client agency relationships or even within agencies themselves, right? Because I also imagine, and I'm projecting here fully, that there's like a danger of becoming, of advertising being perceived as sort of this snake oil salesman. There's easy to overpromise and underdeliver a lot of the results for these things. And I think maintaining a level of rigor and honesty about it is how you build, again, like trust and that lasting relationship. And I think you can see the hints of that throughout the document.
On page 2, there's a really interesting observation about how you balance rigor and creativity, because he talks about, this is an approach to planning advertising, any systematic approach to planning advertising has to do more than simply provide controls and disciplines. It must actively stimulate imagination and creativity too. And so he captures in those couple of lines the paradox that's at the heart of something that is called, if you like, creative planning. That's creativity and planning are totally contradictory concepts, which I think is partly what makes it such an interesting like way to earn a living. But the guide as a whole, not least with those questions we were just talking about, the way it poses questions, balances kind of structure and freedom and rules and how to break them. And to hold those two things together, that paradoxical, contradictory combination, and do that all within, 34 pages, I think is just, very impressive and hugely useful. What a man.
Agreed. what I like about this as well is he says, I think he might say this a couple of times, that setting strategies is a creative act. So, you know, there's a separate department. You've got the planning creative department, but actually there is it is a creative act to set strategies. So I think that was an important point that he made.
Absolutely. It's a partnership, isn't it? That's what comes through really clearly in this. And planning is in service of creativity, in service of creative people. And that really shines through in this as well.
Are you concerned that young marketers today who maybe overemphasize the tactical side of advertising are not reading documents such as the JWT Planning Guide, either because they're unaware that it even exists or that they actually don't think the advice given half a century ago is worth reading today?
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm necessarily concerned for young marketers. I do think there is, again, an industry responsibility to train young marketers. And I don't think that we have necessarily done it particularly well. Again, I think Josh and I are both byproducts of being like reasonably self-directed young individuals who sort of went seeking answers for ourselves. But I don't think that we can expect like all strategists to be excellent, sort of just like born out of the head of Zeus, like Athena, right? Like they have to be taught. They have to be taught and they have to be given these resources. And I think it does put an undue burden on them to sort of assume that they find it. Now, the pitfalls that I think young marketers tend to fall into that I think the planning guide really helps to pull back on is, I think, again, going back to the four C's, I think that young marketers are incredibly good at understanding culture and maybe where the product is positioned within the category. They're great at doing that analysis. I think where they tend to fall down is the sort of so what, making sure that we're tying it back to like the heritage of the company, why something can win in the market and be uniquely ownable by the brand ultimately at the end of the day. And I think they're also, I think, are very focused on sort of like the tactic or the item in front of them. So it might be the task brief, it might be the campaign and how it's been sort of briefed in by the client. But I think that it's easy to forget about the sort of longevity of the relationship and like maintaining things afterwards. Like, I mean, I'll even admit to this pitfall myself. One of my greatest successes was launching a product for e-surance a number of years ago. And then we sort of like launched it and left it. There was never like any ongoing measure of like the effectiveness for the brand. I don't think there was any maintenance plan to go with it. And it was just because like I got to the finish line and I was like, oh, I completely didn't think about anything else. And I think those are the common pitfalls I see that, again, I think with Stephen King's experience and again, longevity within JWT, he'd already had a 20-year tenure at this point. He'd been around the block. He's seen how to build those relationships. And I think you see that experience come to bear in the document and the guides around things like the planning cycle, around making sure that we're pairing things back to the company, that we're gauging customer reactions to the advertisement. It's not just the advertisement itself at the end of the day.
I agree. I wouldn't criticize young marketers or young agency folk so much as the industry that they've come into because of some of the constraints on our world, particularly around budgets or time or what's expected of people. And I'm on the committee of the account planning group, or the APG, which is the industry body for planners here in the UK and around the world, I believe. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is less and less investment in training, which seems to be a casualty a lot of the time of budgets and declining budgets. But people are self-serving in the entrepreneurial way that you were describing, Rachel. But I think we've got a concern about the quality of some of the offerings out there and some of the punditry that's offered and people offering training on LinkedIn and the like that doesn't have the level of rigor or the level of kind of lived experience that is clear in this guide, for example. So I think it is an issue, and I think the industry doesn't invest as well as it should. And that's another symptom of short-termism, isn't it? If people were conversant with this and some of the other foundational texts, our work would be that much more efficient and effective.
Josh, that brings me on to another question that I had. So if we park the JWT planning guide for a minute, are there any other marketing documents that are full of wisdom about the craft of how to do advertising effectively that you'd want to put on a reading list for people just joining the industry?
There's one that I particularly like that I think is harder to find. I probably need to do my service to the industry and make sure to put it on a slideshare. But it is from there's two that I particularly like. One is an internal Coca-Cola document from around like 1999, 2000, which was made in cooperation with Wieden and Kennedy. But it is specifically like how to write a creative brief. And I think like that really starts to address the sort of symbiosis that exists between both agency and client. Like there is a responsibility of the client to distill and tell you. And I think, again, Stephen King says it somewhere in this document. I don't have it right in front of me. But it does require the client to tell you, like, what are our business objectives? Who are our customers that we're going after? What are our sales targets? And a lot of those are addressed in there. It was like packaged into like a little briefing book that was given out to every new marketing trainee that joined during those years, which I think is incredible.
That sounds great. Yeah. I'd love to see that. Get it. Yeah. Post it, share it.
Yeah, let me send it to y'all, or I'll make sure to put it on LinkedIn somewhere. I do need to, because it is great. It is like it's such a funny artifact that I have too, because I just have somebody who took photographs of the little book, like compiled into a PDF. Like it's such an apocryphal document. At the end of the day, and the other one that's also from the 1970s, but I think is really helpful by Alan Hodges, is called Testing to Destruction. And it's really around creative development research, but it's just sort of like this firsthand account of a woman's walk into the grocery store, right? And we all know, you know, the big change that was also happening at that time was that, you know, between the 50s and the 70s was like the development of the supermarket, like a mega switch from the local market, which was also the part of why our relationship with advertising and all these products change. But I think it is a good debunking tool for some of those like idealized purchase path journeys that we tend to fall into, where we're like, oh, somebody has like some, you know, something top of mind and they're browsing and they just happen to encounter your ad that's perfectly placed at exactly the right time and it spurs them into action. And it is like completely divorced from any reality of what, how a human behaves. And so again, while dated and while maybe like a little sexist, I would say it's still a fairly timely piece of material that I think brings some necessary realism to our day-to-day.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you for sharing those, Rachel. And Josh, over to you.
I'm going to go with a one-liner, actually, which is, we've been talking a lot about a British advertising visionary, Stephen King. We've got a name above the door here, Leo Burnett in London, which the man himself, Leo Burnett, obviously. So, yeah, one of the legends of the US industry. And there's a phrase of his that we still use a lot. He's very quotable, actually, Leo Burnett. There's a lot of quotes from him. But there's one that we've particularly focused on in the last few years and refer back to. And he said, at the end of the day, we're just people talking to people. And that's what we need to keep running through our fingers. And I think that's such a timeless sense check when you can get easily distracted by the advertising industry's newest phase or fad. But at the end of the day, it's always about people talking to people. There's just a new set of tools that may become available to help you do that. So that I find endlessly useful as a reminder and call to arms of what we're actually here for.
I love that.
Yeah. He's got loads, Leo Burnett. You could do a proper little book of Leo Burnettisms if you want to. I'm sure someone will have done. But that one would be first among equals of many things that the great man said.
Yeah, I love it.
Wonderful. Lastly, if you were writing the guide today, quite a big question, but what would you add to it? Like, basically, how would you build upon it?
I think that's such a hard question, because I think to what I said earlier around like the Bauhaus distilling a lot of the foundations of design, Stephen King truly did distill a lot of the basic aspects of planning around, you know, what are communication plans? What are the things that you can and can't influence? How should you sort of start assessing at any points in the journey? If anything, I do think the one thing that is left out is, I think, understanding the role that brands play in culture. Like, there's that very helpful chart that's on page 6, which talks about all of the total impressions of the brand. And there's this academic named Tim Huang who has talked about, you know, the idea that, like, brand is a shared hallucination. It is just what everyone has agreed this brand represents and is. And I do think that that is something where, because culture is much more divided and nuanced, having some guidelines around how to either like navigate it or positively influence it, or even like to stay above the fray, which I don't think was as required in the 70s, or things were much more in like lockstep from a media perspective. But now I think is much trickier for a lot of brands to navigate.
I was going to say something related and very similar, and I love that shared hallucination phrase. Never heard that before. Definitely going to be stealing that one with pride. I was going to talk actually about, there's so much more we have learned actually in the interim about how the brain works, neuroscience, and biases like behavioral economics, which isn't reflected. And I think that would point to the one area which he's actually puts his finger on, which is the social influence. I think this is what you're also talking to Rachel as well. But the extent to which we're influenced by one another, I think we understand that a lot better now, the effects of social norming, etc. He talks to the social importance when he talks about indirect contribution. He talks about three roles. Advertising can emphasize the functional values, add non-functional values, or promote word of mouth recommendations. So it's there as one of the three things that advertisers could do. So he put it front and center. But I think on that one pager of all the things that frame one's perception of brand, now we would put the behavior, the perceptions, what others say. I think this also points to something which I believe that the fact that he's got promoting word of mouth in there, like all media are social media. We often can put them into a box and say, it's got social media. Those are the ones that are about word of mouth. Like over the all of the last 50 years, media were playing an incredibly social effect, whether it was quite as immediately visible via technology or not. It's always been social. And he was ahead of the game on that as much as anything by saying one of the three roles for advertising is to promote word of mouth. But I think we'd now have a slightly richer and better understanding of exactly how that operates and the extent to which that should be reflected on that chart that you mentioned, Rachel.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Josh. And thanks to you, Rachel, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. Walk subscribers can access the JWT Planning Guide and indeed lots more frameworks and advice about effective advertising on walk.com. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, subscribe to the Walk podcast on your podcasting platform of choice. Until next time, thank you for listening.